From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Today, OSU professor Ben McCorkle continues Writer's Talk's recent attention to technology as he guest interviews Wired senior maverick Kevin Kelly. Enjoy.
Oh, hello and welcome to Writer's Talk. My name is Ben McCorkle. I'm a professor of English at The Ohio State University, and I'm guest interviewing today. With me today is none other than Kevin Kelly. Truly a privilege and a delight to be able to speak with him today. He has a number of accolades. He's co-founder and currently the senior maverick at Wired Magazine. He's been responsible for launching the Hacker Conference, the Well. He's one of the foremost thinkers about technology today. He's had a couple of books out, Out of Control, New Rules for the New Economy, and currently his most recent book is called What Technology Wants. And this truly is a tour de force. It's a long view history of technology as it's interwoven with the evolution of biology. I would say it's a provocative book, it's an ambitious book, and ultimately it's an important book. So, Kevin Kelly, thank you for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's really my pleasure and honor to be here.
I was wondering if we could get started by just having you give us the elevator pitch for your book. In other words, just tell us generally what it's about.
What Technology Wants is an attempt to provide a theory, a proto-theory of technology. It's sort of like, I feel we're sort of at the same time in history that biology was at the beginning of the 1800s when naturalists just collected things and their view of nature was sort of one thing after another, just these large collections of stuff without really any theory about how they all interconnected. And Darwin came along and provided a theory to explain the relatedness and the kind of the framework to understand all these things that we saw in nature. And I have the feeling that the same thing was true of technology, that technology in our own heads was sort of just like one long parade of one thing after another. There was this year, there's this thing, next year, there's the next thing, and then there's the next thing and the next thing. And there's no real kind of framework for understanding how these are coming about, what the pattern of their arrival is, how they're connected, what they mean, how they fit into the larger cosmos. And I try to offer a framework for understanding technology, and it may not be a surprise that actually I'm offering the same framework for technology that biology has, which is the theory of evolution. My theory of what technology wants is that it wants the same thing that evolution of life wants, and it wants it in the same way that evolution wants things. It's not intellectual, it's not conscious, it's a tendency, a bias in the system to move in certain directions. So that's what the book is about.
Wonderful. And this is a history that you stretch back even before human existence even. You know, technological tendencies have been in the machine before we came along.
Yes, I think technology precedes us and will outlive us. That the story, the trajectory of the forces that work in the technium began at the Big Bang and are moving through the cosmos, the bios, now the technos, and it will go beyond us. And so this is a very long story.
Playing off of that, one of the questions I had is early on in the book, you kind of take on Marshall McLuhan's notion of technology as extensions of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And by kind of adjusting that and saying, well, McLuhan's idea of technology as being extensions of the body, extensions of the arm, extensions of the eye and so forth, doesn't really get at the essence of technology. And you go one step further to suggest that technology is more or less about the extension of ideas. I was wondering if you could talk a little more about that, what it might mean for the evolution of the technium as we move forward.
Well, there are several things to say about the kind of McLuhanist idea of the technium being extensions of ourselves. I think that it's stronger than just extending ourselves. I think it actually is the definition of ourselves, that our own humanity, that our humanity is basically something that we invented, that it comes out of the technium and our technology. Or anything that we would associate that I think that makes us different from animals really are things that we have invented. We have created ourselves with our minds. We have made our sense of of ethics. We have created our sense of justice. We have made laws. And that, in that sense, our humanity is something that we invented. And as we kind of move into the next phase of a kind of an idea-based world where the things that we create and the things that we think of become ever more important, we will continue that sense of inventing ourselves. And I think that's what we're doing with the technium.
This is one of the points of provocation that I see kind of coming out of this book.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other technology thinkers and philosophers of technology I've read, I won't name names, tend to think in the opposite direction of you. Like, in other words, this sense of technology as an active agent, almost inevitably progressing mm-hmm. as a force, this kind of runs counter to a lot of other thinkers, mm-hmm. a lot of other current thinking related to technology. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced any personal blowback because of this position, or how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's interesting because there are two reactions. One is there are a large set of critics, people who are critic in the sense of who are unhappy with the general direction of technology, and I would include among them people like Maurice Maclou and a lot of the other French philosophers of technology. They were unhappy with it, but they acknowledged that there was this inherent agency in technology. So the Unabomber would be another one like that. They were saying, actually, no, there is this inherent agency, and it's not good. Then there's another set of people who say, no, there's no inherent agency. It's totally up to us. We have control and free will in this. And any suggestion that there's an agency in technology is a surrendering of this important freedom that we have. It's kind of like it's like giving into it. And so my position is sort of like the third one, which is I'm agreeing in some senses with the harshest critics of technology and saying, no, actually, there is an agenda. However, the agenda is a positive agenda. And I have to say that, you know, I'm in a very small group of people who would say that, that there's an agenda and it's positive. But I believe that in the long term, you know, I think more people will come around to seeing that. And the evidence of that is just basically 2,000, 10,000 years of history. If you look back, all this theory is an extension of what's happened in 2,000 years. And so I think it's, you know, it's like a lot of the things. If my reading of history, I think it says progress is real. The people who say there's no agenda have to say if they look back in history and they say there is no progress.
Sure.
And so it comes down to how you want to read history.
Speaking of which, earlier you alluded to the Unabomber.
Right.
And I see that as perhaps one of your more provocative moments in What Technology Wants. This is a chapter called The Unabomber Was Right.
Mm-hmm.
From where I sit, it seems not sensational so much as it is a sober, clear-headed reflection of the ideas expressed in his manifesto, but balanced with an acknowledgement of his moral failings. But still, I can imagine that it's probably pushed some buttons among your readers. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk about the reaction to this section, both as you were drafting it and since it's been published.
When I was drafting it, even people like my agent were really adverse to it. They thought that it was going to be doomed the book. But curiously, I knew that wasn't going to happen because I already posted some of these writings on the web and not a single person objected to it. And in fact, it's probably the least controversial aspect of the book, much to my surprise. I think people generally understood what I was trying to say, which is, you know, Unabomber was right intellectually and totally wrong in terms of his ethics and his actions, how he acted upon these things and becoming a murderer, a serial murderer. But It turned out that the fact that, you know, the one of the best and clearest critics of, or I would say philosophers of technology is the Unabomber was actually not so controversial. Far more controversial were my claims about the fact that there are trends in evolutionary biology. That is what really upsets thinking people most.
Sure. You delve into those waters, I think you'll stir up some muck. It's like you're anticipating some of my questions. I know that what technology wants in large part started off on your blog, the Technium.
Mm-hmm.
You developed much of the draft in that space. So I was wondering if you could talk about that process a little bit.
Yeah.
What was it like writing in such a public space?
This is in some ways kind of a new way to write a book. Although, you know, there are plenty of historical antecedents from Dickens onward who wrote serially and published as they went along. I think it's maybe not so common with a nonfiction book. Although I had colleagues, including Chris Anderson and John Battelle, who had written their books sort of out loud in the same way. And one of the things that I knew before going in, and it turned out to be true, which was that this is not a way to save time. This is not something where, okay, yeah, I can write this and then I'll have written it and I can, you know, oh my gosh, this is going to be a quicker way to do it. This does not save any time at all. In fact, it makes a lot more time, and the extra time comes in the fact that generally you're writing a lot more than would ever be used. Generally, you are changing your mind as you write, so you're writing lots of things that just are going to be wrong and so not used. Two, there's just the added time of cultivating the conversation, responding to comments, and then, you know, the fact that you're changing your mind and having to go in different directions. So the result of all that extra time, though, is that you get a better book. And
sure.
The simplest way I can say it is, imagine if you had all the, you know, people writing in saying, you missed this, this is wrong, and you had all that happen before you wrote the book, then you can put it into the book. And this is exactly what happened, is that there are actually very few corrections needed in the book because it's sort of been already corrected. And it kind of goes back to Clay Shirky's idea of the switch in publishing, which it used to be that you published, that you edited first and then published, and now you publish and then edit. And so I benefited from the fact that there were many eyes on this, that there was a conversation going already. It was more work, but it made a better book.
And when you hold this up against the other types of writing you've done over the years, like say the other two books, which I imagine were done in a more traditional sense, the work you've done with Wired, various columns, your blogging, how does this process compare to those other processes?
Well, writing a book is a different scale than just writing magazine articles, which is a different scale than just writing a blog. And as you increase the length, you kind of square the complexity for every doubling in the length. And I think, I'm not sure I would write a magazine article this way. Actually, Wired for a while tried to do that. They tried to have the writers sort of write out loud as they were writing an article. And I don't think the scale is right. It's actually much easier to just write the article, put it out, and then do corrections on it.
Sure.
Than it is to kind of like pre-write it out loud. A book is a more longer sustained argument that has many little pieces, and it makes it possible to do a book that way. So I think there is an involvement, and there is a kind of a way to kind of do crowdsourcing with smaller pieces, but I think it becomes actually more effective when you have a longer thing that has a longer duration. And I mean, that's my experience right now. I put up blogging things, but and I can correct them, but I'm not sure that you just want to put out paragraphs and have people respond to those.
I was wondering a little bit about style in this book. For such a technical subject, your writing comes across, for me at least, is very lyrical, almost poetic in spots.
Thank you.
So I was wondering if that is something that you consciously cultivated, or if otherwise just how you naturally write, or whatever that means. What drives your style?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I have to be honest, this is the first time I've been asked about it. My first reaction is to just say it's probably a little bit of how I write, but I think it's not completely true. I think it is the sense, I think I do reward myself for writing like that. Okay. So in other words, it is something that I aspire to. And so, but it also is something that I kind of tend to do. And so both of those are going, I tend to do them when it works, I say, oh, that's good. Let me see if I can do that again. But it is something I move in that direction. So I have a more telegraphic kind of writing. I like to really reduce things to, I mean, I really like that kind of, I don't know, you know, of lyrical reduction, of really minimizing things, rather than others who may enjoy the kind of complexity, you know, of really making something very, very layered and beautifully complex. I tend to want to go more telegraphic. I think that came out of the fact that actually I learned to write online in messages and emails. And so I became a writer by writing emails. And so in a certain sense, you could say that my writing is kind of like a bunch of emails. I don't know. So anyway, I mean, in that sense of trying to be concise and clear and communicate, that's what I'm trying to do. In fact, my first book came out of what we would now call blogs. Mm-hmm. I blogged a conference, an artificial life conference, and I blogged every single talk in it, and I put it up on the Well in, you know, 85 or 87, I can't remember when that was. And that response to those kind of summaries, really quick summaries online, the response to that was the impetus to do my first book. And so as much as I think about my style, I am maybe thinking about it, you know, really trying to communicate something clearly to another person when you don't have the body language and you don't have the, you know, voice tones and stuff. And it, as if it was, I'm trying to, you know, convince someone in email. And we all know how difficult that is to actually be clear in email.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with guest interviewer OSU Professor Ben McCorkle, talking with Wired senior maverick and author of What Technology Wants, Kevin Kelly.
You just reminded me of a piece I read in the New York Times, a composition teacher who was talking about reconfiguring his approach to teaching writing based on things like, you know,
Twitter.
Twitter and blogs and eBay descriptions and all of that.
Yeah, he said Amazon reviews, right? Write a two-sentence Amazon review of your book. And, you know, that's very much, and in fact, and I should have mentioned that, you know, also out of my Whole Earth catalog days where we would have to review a book in a paragraph. More than review, in some sense, it's kind of sell a book in a paragraph. And that kind of brevity of a kind of, you know, I don't know, condensation, distillation is a challenge that I sort of have been applying to myself for 25 years. And I think if I have whatever style I have, probably has come out of that. But also, I have to say that I'm kind of maybe naturally inclined in that direction anyway.
Sure. Yeah, I was thinking also your Cool Tools site is kind of driven towards that small kind of blurbish kind of writing.
Yes, right.
So I want to get back into some of the content of the book, particularly what I call the Amish question.
Yeah.
So in What Technology Wants, you devote a chapter to talking about Amish culture and their rather complex relationship to technology, which I think might surprise some readers not familiar with that culture. I'm wondering if you could discuss a little bit about the lessons you've learned from the Amish, particularly instances in your personal life where you opt for older, outmoded, or obsolete technologies instead of the new, flashy, shiny things. What drives those decisions?
The influence of the Amish are subtle, but and it takes a little bit to explain actually what the Amish system is, because against stereotypes, counterintuitively, the Amish are not Luddites. They are not anti-technology. It turns out that they're actually, in my view, very pro-technology. They're kind of tinkerers and makers and hackers in many sense. They actually kind of love technology. They just have a different set of constraints. And importantly to the story, the Amish have articulated those constraints, because unlike you and I, we are selecting technology all the time.
Sure.
But we do it individually. We're kind of the American individualists, and so we have our own little, I'll do this, but I'm not do that. I've got, you know, You know, I'm not going to do vinyl, or I'm not going to do, I'll drive a, you know, electric car, but not a gas car. I'll, you know, not have TV or not, you know, all these, we have all these selections that we do, but we're done individually. The Amish do them as a community. And that, because they do them as a community, requires them to actually articulate and even write down what those selection criteria are. And so they're aware of them. And then knowing what they are, they can kind of go hog crazy in adopting the stuff that they can use and hacking the, like anyone else, like anyone in the world, they're kind of constantly hacking, looking for loopholes and stuff. And it seems rather silly, but it's, again, it's something we all do. So, you know, there was this Amish guy who spent a half hour telling me how he rigged up his horse and buggy to have LED turn signals. So when he's going to make a right-hand turn, he has a little switch, and the LEDs on his horse and buggy, they signal where he's going to turn. Of course, this is someone who, they don't have electricity in his home. And he's not driving a car, but he's got turn signals on his horse and buggy, just because he can. And there's something called Amish electricity, which is really pneumatics. And so they don't have electricity in their homes, but they have a great big, smelly, loud diesel generator back of the barn that they feed diesel fuel tool.
Right.
And it generates compressed air. And those compressed air lines run to mostly run the milking machines for their cows. Most of them are dairy farmers. That's their cash crop. And but while they have it there, hey, they've got a couple other lines coming into the house. And so they have another cottage industry of all these Amish guys who modify appliances, electric appliances,
sure.
to turn them into air-powered ones. So they've got pneumatic washing machines, pneumatic dryers, pneumatic blenders, pneumatic sewing machines. And so they have these pneumatic lines running through their house, and they have all these appliances, and out in a workshop, they've got saws and drill presses, and they're running what they call Amish electricity and running off of diesel oil. And so you look at that and you say, that's not really kind of like is that self-reliance? Is that kind of, you know, is this organic? And, that's just the beginning of the many contradictions. But the point is that they love technology, they have technology, but they have a selection that they're using to decide whether they adopt something or not. And they know that it is, and I find it really interesting. And once they have those, they just kind of do everything they can within those constraints.
And it evolves too. We're calling from Columbus, Ohio, and about an hour up the road, there's an Amish population.
Yes.
There's also a hardware store there called Lehman Brothers.
Yes.
And they have, it's like stepping into bizarro world. The gas-powered refrigerators are these so wood-burning stoves that are so ornate and so decorative, the composting toilets and all of this. I feel like I've stepped into this an alternative technological universe where things developed along a different evolutionary trend. It's an interesting connection, likening the Amish to perhaps their distant cousins, the hackers, the makers, the kind of DIY folks, you know, maybe even the steampunk movement, but all of these things that have kind of emerged recently, not to suggest they didn't exist before, but it seems like they're becoming increasingly more mainstream, or at least on our radar more. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what role you see these kind of marginal areas of our culture playing in helping shape the technium.
Well, I'm a huge believer that all change happens at the margins, that's sort of the the evolutionary viewpoint, that innovations, mutations, advances, all these things happen at the edges of the population. They don't happen in the center. They're kind of gradually move from the edges to the center. And that if you want to look at the where things are going, you always look at the edges and the margins and the subcultures. And so, and you know, I was kind of came out of the hippie 60s and worked for the whole catalog. And you know, all I can say is things like, you know, organic foods have been a long time coming, but they were definitely it came from the margins. We thought maybe they'd be adopted long before this, but Now you go into Safeway and they have, you know, entire mainstream brands around this, Trader Joe's and all that kind of stuff. But this is something that very definitely began at the margins, and the do-it-yourself kind of things is still a marginal subculture at the edges. But that's where change happens. That's where the future begins. That's where it's first kind of distributed. And I think that's why it pays to look at and focus on the edges as the place of change, rather than, you know, whatever's at the center at the current time.
The last question I want to talk about, well, it has to do with one of your maybe colleagues, Stephen Berlin Johnson. Mm-hmm. You both came out with books at roughly the same time. His latest is Where Good Ideas Come From. They both have similar scopes and theses. And I know you've talked about this in other interviews. An interesting thing about this, and maybe even slightly ironic about this bit of convergence, it's something that both of you talk about. It's an actual illustration of the kind of simultaneous insights the two of you discuss in your respective books. How, in other words, certain inventions, they don't just spring forth out of a solitary genius's mind. It's like culture willed them into being, and they came out, you know, if not this person, then this person or this group of people. Have the two of you talked about this coincidence and what it means in terms of your respective arguments?
So independently, Steve and I wrote our books without, you know, really discussing what we were writing at all. So we had no knowledge of what was in our books, but we both simultaneously and independently wrote about simultaneous and independent invention. How the fact that the norm in inventions, the norm in discoveries and patents, is that almost everything is invented simultaneously, independently by more than one person. Stephen's point about this was that the idea of the lone genius was totally wrong, and that ideas happen as networks, that there's many people involved because it's kind of in the air. And that when things happen, it's not a single person, that almost in every case, if you unravel the story, you find out that there's multiple people with the same idea at the same time and many people involved in any new idea. My point in the simultaneous independent invention was the fact that a lot of these inventions are inevitable, which is a kind of a stronger, more controversial take on it. But I'm saying that it's evidence, the fact that these things happen as the norm, that whenever something is being invented, more than one person has the same idea at the same time independently, that this is indication that the larger form, the generic, or I should say the kind of the genre form of it, is inevitable, that it would happen no matter who thought of it. And that that's an indication that there is this kind of force, this agency moving through technology that is constrained by the fact that certain things like the web, connecting everybody to everybody else, or, you know, electronic communication, these things were inevitable at the larger form scale, although the specifics aren't. And I think you know, Steve and I had no idea we were writing about the same kind of phenomena. We only discovered it when we read each other's books at the end. I think it does illustrate perfectly well the very fact that, yeah, the idea is in the air. A lot of people are now writing about it, and it's inevitable.
I love that take on it, because being someone kind of ensconced in academia, there's that sense of paranoia that permeates every bit of writing you do, that someone else has done it first, someone else has said it first, but you guys kind of embraced it. It actually enacted what you were talking about.
Yeah, actually, I mean, it's regarding maybe a little tangential, but I think I now take that kind of a sense of we're all kind of rushing to get something out because we feel other people are right behind us, or maybe they're even a little ahead of us. I now take that as a sign that I shouldn't be doing this at all. Because it's like, why I should be doing things that nobody's going to do. And so I think that's a much harder thing to do, to find. But I think it's actually more valuable in the end. So anyway, that's one thing I've changed my mind about recently is if other people are kind of having this idea, then that says, okay, let them do it. I don't need to do that.
The book is What Technology Wants. The author is Kevin Kelly, and it has been a true pleasure to speak with you, sir. Thank you.
I appreciate your interest in my book, and thanks for the great questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more Writers Talk interviews, visit www.writerstalk.org. Writers Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel. where you can watch our interviews at www.ohiochannel.org. Join me next week for my talk with Jim and Nancy Petro, authors of False Justice, and Friday, April 15th, six-string concert performer Irene Kelly. Until then, this is Doug Dangler. Keep writing.